Golden Medics Podcast. I'm here with Dr. CJ DePalma and our very special guest, Ben Cormack, who is a really smart guy in the physiotherapy, pain, movement versus exercise, ALSAC, all of these different things that we're hoping to get into today. And I'm extremely excited. I can't even talk. So I'm going to go ahead and let Ben introduce himself while I collect myself.
Yeah, you do that. You do that, sir. So look, my name is Ben Cormack. I am a musculoskeletal-based therapist. I am from London in the UK. I own a company called Core Kinetic, which I used to have this super cool job where I traveled the world teaching people about stuff. Now I just sit at home in front of a computer doing things like that. It used to be really great meeting people and like having a life and that type of thing. So that was really good. But this whole COVID thing came along and messed all that up. And also I run something called the Better Clinician Project alongside Adam Meekins, the sports physio, which is something we set up last year and is again in the educational space. What else do I say? So yeah, I've had the pleasure of traveling all around the world teaching and presenting at conferences. And, you know, I'm sure people will have bumped into me talking crap on the internet at some point or another.
And are you treating currently? Are you doing any in-person treating? I know when I saw you had doing your own thing, or maybe like going off on your own compared to where you were or something, but do you do any in-person treatment or any actual like one-on-one treating currently?
Yeah, I probably do about maybe some weeks I could have 10 patients, some weeks like the week after Christmas, I had like 2 patients. So it's like kind of most of the stuff I've been doing is online based. Unfortunately, with the way things are in the UK, clinics have been affected and things like that. So I took a decision just to do things online. And again, I get a lot of international clients, so it's easier just to do it online. But yeah, still talking to people. I would say my years of doing 30, 40 patients a week are probably not quite what they were, but I do like to still keep my hand doing this stuff.
Gotcha.
Yeah, before we hopped on, I was talking about my job where I met CJ at, and I was doing like 18 to 22 a day there. 30 to 40 weeks sounds like a good time. So yeah, it's definitely cool. How are you finding the remote stuff versus the in-person stuff?
So look, it's you need a different skill set. And again, you know, you can rely less on you know, the classical approach of testing and treating, and you have to use different skills. You have to, you know, improve the way that you talk to people. I think you probably improve the way that you listen and how you go about treating people. You know, it's very much more about helping people to self-manage and what they can do for themselves versus treating people in the traditional sense that we were all trained in.
Sure. Definitely the subjective and interview skills have to be through the roof, which is probably a really like great thing to work on, you know, those quote unquote soft skills, which probably should be renamed at this point.
Yeah, look, I mean, I've always, you know, I think I've always liked to approach these things as what I describe as a clinical conversation. So I've never been the hyper professional suit and tie type when it comes to work.
Oh, really?
You know, that probably comes across. So, you know, I've always treated things in a way that are very conversational, that hopefully I think are quite relatable. If I have any skills in this world, it might be talking to people, you know, although, you know, some might suggest I'm not good at that either. But, you know, that type of style has always suited my personality and the way that I do things better anyway. And I would say that I've probably been doing that over a number of years. And once upon a time, that was probably more frowned upon. Now it's starting to be more accepted as something that might be a useful skill.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we operate remote, like a remote patient athlete management via rehab and kind of like a remote training concept with like a rehab flair. And we've been doing that for like 2.5 years now, maybe close to 3. We found great outcomes, you know, and so it's nice to hear someone with more clout than us that is able to do it and able to justify it more so than us just wanting to work with people that maybe don't live in our state. They just live far away and having to go through all the rigors of any of that stuff. So, but yeah, we found success. Our business is purely remote and online as well. I think I see like one person in person, and Joe treats his dad like in his garage. His dad really just does deadlifts in his garage. So
that's right.
So yeah, we're right there with you with, being able to, just conversate with people and help them manage and maybe just create a different persona of what rehab has to look like. So that's cool. I learned a lot of that from your course, which was great. I mean, it was super influential in the way that I treat.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So as somebody who teaches, who's spoken at the San Diego Pain Summit, which is super cool, who's been doing this for at least longer than CJ and I have, there's some things that I kind of wanted to ask to get out of the way to kind of host the rest of a conversation. And the first is always a kind of silly question that I'm kind of realizing now, but like, what is pain? Do we even need to know it? Should we stop researching a definition? In your view, what is it?
Well, I mean, I suppose if I was to, you know, if you were to give me 1 second to answer, pain to me is whatever the person says it is, you know, because it what else could I ever suggest it is, if that makes sense? So one of the things I think we have to remember about pain, and, you know, there's lots talked about it and there's lots of opinions and this, that, and the other, I think that we can never penetrate someone else's subjective pain experience. Yeah. You know, there is no objective measure of pain. So, you know, I've gone through many years of kind of delving into pain and many stages in my own perceptions and my own developments around pain, you know, from being very interested in the kind of neurobiology to, you know, the very technical aspects of it, to maybe more of a person focused perspective around pain. And I think you have to come to the end and just say pain is what people perceive it to be. I could never turn around and tell someone else what their pain is or tell someone else what they're experiencing isn't real, you know? And I think that's part of the problem, is that we are trying to define what pain is overall and what someone else's pain experience might be. And in the end, is that just futile? Does it just get in the way? You know, what I really want to do is help this person. So if I want to understand what pain is, I probably need to understand what the person in front of me perceives it to be. Because what if my perception and the other person's perception don't fit? Right? We've got a problem there, haven't we? What am I going to do? Tell them that they're wrong? Am I wrong? Or does it just not matter? Maybe they're just two different perceptions. So sometimes this unifying principle of what pain is and what should we tell people it is should really be secondary to actually finding out, you know, what does the person in front of me see it as? How do they experience it? And then, you know, not just that, but what does it mean to them? And I think that's the thing that we really miss. It's not the sensation. And that's what we focus on, the neurobiology of the sensation and how we, you know, how the intensity works. But how does that affect the person? How do they feel about it? What are their perceptions? And there's a paper by a guy called Per Brodel, which really changed my kind of view on all this, which is talking about, you know, it's not the pain itself and it's not the injury, but it's our perception and the meaning of that to the person. And then if you look at kind of Leventhal's work, where they're talking about the common sense model, which again is about the interpretation of the problem. And so we really need to park the idea sometimes that we are the arbiters of the pain experience and just give it up and just say, what does this other person think? What do they feel? How does it affect them? So do we need to know exactly what pain is? I probably don't give a shit, if I'm being honest.
Sure. That's funny.
Yeah. I mean, with the new definition from the IASP, I saw a lot of that, like people saying, who gives a shit? You know, why do we really need to break down this complex? Why do we need to even define it if that doesn't really help? And it even might hinder our ability to try and communicate that or help other people that are in pain. Like, they don't care what the definition is. And, yeah, it's definitely an interesting way to watch the pendulum kind of swing.
But I do want to make the point also, what my opinion is doesn't matter to what your opinion is, matters to another person as well. You know, again, I'm full of opinions, but I'm also aware they are my opinions. And I don't, you know, if other people want to, you know, argue for hours or not even argue, just talk about what is pain, then that's up to them. I have no issue with that. That's the use of their time. For me, you know, these are stages that I've reached. And also I've been writing about for years, you know, these kind of ideas that pain maybe isn't our focus. Maybe it's the person in pain that should be our focus. You know, I probably started doing some blogs on that about 4 or 5 years ago, and everyone hated me for a while because I was challenging this new idea of pain science, which, you know, which shouldn't be challenged sometimes. But, you know, opinions are like arseholes. Everyone's got one. I've got a massive one.
Sure. Sure. So do you think that your the patient-centered focus is like what initially started to pull you away from like our traditional schooling and teaching of like pathological diagnoses and like tissue pathology? And like so that will parlay that into the other question. What about the patient that is like comes from a very, very, very like tissue-driven, like biomechanical reasoning background from other physios or MDs? Like, how do you manage that situation? So your thoughts and like how you kind of transitioned from schooling to where you are now, and then how do you manage the patient that's very much stuck in the mechanical reasoning mindset?
Yeah, again, look, my journey has, you know, through thought and concepts and principles, it's been like everyone else's. You know, you kind of are exposed to different things. I have this really annoying part of my personality that questions everything. And if someone tells me not to do something, then I tend to kind of do the opposite as well, which is really annoying, probably really irritating for people around me. You know, but it's kind of, you know, and sometimes that can be beneficial. And actually, sometimes it can also be detrimental, like all of our personality traits. So, you know, for me, it's just a kind of a point of sometimes you go down these rabbit holes, and this might be biomechanical, it might be pain science, it might be whatever else. And I think sometimes you have to ask yourself, does going further down this rabbit hole, does learning more about this enhance what I'm doing? And I felt certainly with pain and things like that, I felt learning more and more and more about some of the complexity and the neurobiology, I didn't feel like it was making too much difference to what I was doing and the outcomes that I wanted to achieve. And so I, you know, kind of from zooming right down into that, you know, I felt that coming back out of that and just focusing on what this person was telling me to some degree made more sense. And I think it made more sense, you know, maybe for my intellect, maybe I'm not smart enough to go down some of these very, very complex roads. And actually it wasn't helping the way that I work. And I think that's super important as well. So you also have to think about, does what you're doing fit your personality and the way that you do things? And sometimes hyper-intellectualism isn't me, because I'm not hyper-intellectual. At the end of the day, I just like talking to people and communicating with people, and hopefully sometimes inspiring people to try some different things and do things in some different ways. And that for me, probably, you know, maybe I'm not smart enough sometimes. And, you know, it does that leads me to come back out of it and say, how can I do my job better with my limitations? That might be part of it. So how do we manage people that do have a kind of a very, you know, hyper focus on these things? Well, again, I think firstly, we have to sometimes find out a little bit of what's driving that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why do people form these beliefs? Where have they picked these beliefs up from? And avoid the writing reflex. I think that's a big problem, is that, you know, when you're the arbiter of the answers, you know, it's like, this is wrong, you're wrong, your beliefs are wrong. And again, they're the things we've got to work with. So regardless of whether they're right or wrong, I've got to work with it. So maybe I need to come back out and start to explore why that's happened. Start to understand a bit of that person's journey, what they've been told, what they've done. Why are they sitting in front of me now? That's important as well, because that might not have been a successful journey for them. So I think sometimes we have to highlight that actually following the same path, the same route and the same ideas haven't been as successful as people have wanted them to be. And it might be another time for a change. But I do think that avoiding, you know, coming across like you've got this whole new set of answers that totally conflict with another set of answers is probably not the right way to do it. You know, imagine being in the pub or the bar, you know, and how do arguments in the bar start, where one person has got strong opinions and another person's got strong opinions, and it turns into an argument, right? Yeah. And sometimes I think you need to park your opinions and listen, and then kind of slowly think about how you can work with this person and their beliefs, rather than always look to change everything and put people right. You know, maybe you've got to work with what you're given sometimes. So rather than think, right, I've got the answer, this is newfangled science that you don't know and I'm going to teach you about it, maybe we just need to park it and say, you know, this is what we're working with. How can we make small adjustments to that? How can we not even challenge? How can we start to get people to maybe try some different things? Do they need to change their belief is the question. Maybe sure. Sometimes they don't.
I'm glad that you brought up the bar, because
right, because it's 7:30.
Right.
I'm just kidding.
Because one of the analogies that I had picked up from the last 4 days of inundating myself with your podcast was the drunk in a bar analogy, which is something that I did for a number of years first out of school. Once learning about this like hashtag wokester PT lifestyle, was let me just educate everybody at length about what their pain is, and that, you know, you can end up being this drunk guy in a bar who's telling somebody their life story that they don't give a shit about.
Yeah, but is it the same as telling people about the biomechanics of their knee? Or is it the same as telling people about, you know, why their disc is impinging on S1 or L5 or whatever? You know, people, I don't want to say how much do they care. I think that's the wrong terminology. But how much does it resonate with their experience, if that makes sense? And I think that we can, you know, some of the things that we've done that we see as newfangled and kind of the new way to do things weren't very different from the old way of doing things. They just had a different topic.
Right. How do you seem to manage navigating the field currently, where it seems like a lot of people are going towards this, we need to really focus more and more on the small stuff, because it does seem to matter. And then the other side, which seems to be the side that you're on, where it's like, let's just care for these people and not concern ourselves so much with the small stuff. How do you kind of navigate between both sides of those fields, if it even is two different sides?
So I think you're going to have to elaborate on what's the small stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we think about, like, I don't know, tendinopathy kind of comes into my brain. Like, there seems to be this weird space where pain with tendinopathy is different than other pain, where it's like pain with tendinopathy is little holes in the tendon, or it is actual like structural change of an area. But with pain with everything else, it's more of just perception of the person or whatever. And so I was kind of curious. Yeah.
Yeah. Correct me. I mean, tendinopathy, you know, I had a long chat with Ebony Rio the other day on the BCP with me and Adam, which is always, you know, really enlightening when it comes to things like tendinopathy. You know, I don't think all pain is the same. You know, I do think if we look at the biology of pain, maybe two different tendon pains might be different. There seems to be a difference between upper limb and lower limb tendons with some of the things that are being studied. Maybe there's a difference between the patella tendon and the Achilles tendon. You know, that's another thing that's quite interesting. So I think the small stuff can matter. But I think we need to be better at doing a bit of both. All pain, regardless, has a person attached. And that probably sounds like, you know, a really cliched load of crap. All right. And I will go and do 100 press ups for saying that. right. But I do think that that is true. You know, I think what we do is we like to say small stuff or big stuff, whereas really we need to do a bit of both, don't we? We need to, and again, this is the point. We've swung from this kind of, you know, knowing lots and lots about pathology to knowing lots and lots about, as you say, maybe it's not big stuff, but it's more all-encompassing stuff.
Right, right.
That might be a better terminology, I think. And in essence, do I still need to know about a pathology to treat it? I think yes, absolutely. So this morning, our new topic on the BCP is radicular pain. So do I need to know a bit about radicular versus radiculopathy versus referred versus entrapment neuropathy versus neuropathic? Yes, I believe I do. But within every one of these problems, is there still other factors that are going to affect the outcomes? You know, whether they are prognostic factors like, you know, people's expectations of recovery or their self-efficacy or these other type of things. So I think I'm in a place now where the big stuff, if that's the, you know, that's the terminology we're using, relates to lots of different pathologies. It's maybe what we would use the term non-specific. So it's not specific to any pathology, but it's specific to people. And different people will have different parts of that specifics to their, to who they are and their personality and their presentation. And then there are specific factors that relate to the problem. And yes, I truly believe that we also need to know some of these things as well. And anyone who turns around and says, you don't need to know anything about, you know, the specifics of a pathology is talking crap. And anyone who says you don't need to know anything about the person and more of the non-specific stuff, they're talking crap as well. So at the end of the day, this is the job we've got into, and it's a big job, unfortunately. And you will never know all of it, probably until you die, and then you'll never know all of it anyway. So I think we have to see it like Sisyphus. It's an uphill battle, but it's the one that we're engaged in, unfortunately. Right.
Much better way of phrasing it than I did. Thank you. Because, well, I mean, I can speak for myself when again, this wokeness comes about, you're like, oh, I don't really need to worry about all of this like specific stuff. If I just tell the person that, you know, they're just perceiving something that is not their, they're just perceiving pain or something, and I don't worry about anything else, and I just get them back to moving, then that's fine. But I think what you're saying is that to be in that position, you have to know more about the specifics and make sure that they are okay and that you are going in a good direction, kind of.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you use the term perception there. And again, there's an assumption about what people are perceiving. And that's what we need to get over. You know, if you want to know what someone's perceiving, then you need to talk to them and find out what that is. And, you know, so again, that's again, maybe why an explanation about pain being this or pain being that, you know, sometimes falls flat. And I think what we really need to let people know that pain is more than pathology. And sometimes what initiates pain is such as an injury or damage doesn't always maintain pain. There are other processes that can occur as well. But again, I think we've swung to this idea that pain is this separate entity that doesn't, you know, have relationships to anything else in the body. And that's what we need to tell people. And really, I think there are much more nuanced messages in there that are about separating what we feel simply from the state of our body. And at the end of the day, I think that's the overriding thing that I would like to get across to people the majority of the time. And I don't know if I need to embellish that anymore. But sometimes I think we can go down a rabbit hole because we try to overcomplicate the messages that we're trying to give people. But I think it's a really useful message to help people understand that pain is more than just, you know, a bone out of place or their posture or, you know, a disc or whatever. That's really important. How far do we go with that is the question, because I think that's when it starts to get messy.
Absolutely. CJ, before I delve into my next topic, do you have anything
that you want to ask? No, I don't think okay. So. No, we're fine. Yeah.
This is good. I told CJ before, I was hoping that you would be able to poke holes in the way that I think about stuff so that I can look that in the face and be like, I need to better update my thinking process. So this is good.
So, you know, I probably poke holes in the way that everyone thinks about things, because I think I'm fairly unique sometimes in the way that I think about things. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing. That might be ultimately a bad thing, but it still is probably unique to me, which, you know, maybe when I have done with this game, there'll be a small celebration, and I'm glad he's out of the way.
It's funny that you say that you question everything, and CJ and I both agree. And as somebody who's currently going through wedding planning, questioning all the traditions that, you know, we go through is very frustrating to my wife. So I'll give her.
I remember I went with my dad many, many years ago to a pub. Again, it's another pub analogy. I'm a Londoner, and we just grow up with pubs.
Yeah.
It is, you know, I'm just a red-faced alcoholic. So I went to a pub and I remember this vividly. And my dad said to the guy behind the bar, meet my son. My son's getting married. And this man turned round. He looked me dead in the eye. He said one word. He said, don't. And that's always stuck with me forever. But I've been married about 15 years. So it's going okay so far.
So my next topic is something that I had listened to a podcast a couple of weeks ago with, I think it was Dr. Chad Cook, discussing self-efficacy. And then you had posted a blog about self-efficacy and the kind of expanses and nuances with self-efficacy, that it's not just this kind of umbrella thing, this like one topic that we can or cannot affect. And so I was curious if you would expand on kind of the ins and outs of self-efficacy as best as you can.
Yeah, I mean, me and Chad had a little discussion about this just after that. But I did the blog quite a long time before this whole other discussion about self-efficacy. And as I understood it, Chad's point was that a lot of the data that we've got around self-efficacy is prognostic. Now, prognostic data is not interventional. So what prognostic data means is it predicts the outcome, but we don't know if we can actually change it. Right? Does that make sense? That actually this is a prognostic piece of information, but we don't know quite yet if it's actually something that we can change, because we need interventional research to be able to make and determine that, right? So there's great work by people like Rachel Chester, for example, who's done lots of stuff into the shoulder. You know, there's been quite a lot of work looking at, you know, self-efficacy versus, you know, things like fear avoidance, et cetera, which is more predictive of a good outcome. Now, what we have to remember is that nearly all that research is about pain self-efficacy. So it's not self-efficacy, it's pain self-efficacy. This is specifically measured via the PSEQ, so the pain self-efficacy questionnaire. So it's our ability as human beings to deal with pain during an exercise or during a movement or during activities of everyday living. Now, one of the mistakes that I think people make is that they apply the idea of self-efficacy just to as a blanket type of statement. So self-efficacy becomes a standalone thing. But if you look at the research, it's never standalone, because it's always measured via a domain. And generally the domain is pain self-efficacy. Now, Bandura, who's the guy behind self-efficacy, said it himself. Self-efficacy is not a universal trait. It relates specifically to an action or an act. And that's the difference between, say, self-efficacy and self-confidence. Self-confidence might span more than one topic, might be more of an umbrella, whereas self-efficacy is measured via the relationship with a task. So exercise self-efficacy, pain self-efficacy. And I think this is my point, that there is no such thing, or people have generated tools that measure self-efficacy across multiple domains. But Bandura himself said, actually, that is probably going down the wrong path, that actually that misses the point of self-efficacy. So, you know, I think we have to be careful about what we mean when we say self-efficacy. So self-efficacy really means my belief in an ability to do something. But that is a something. It's not anything. So, you know, you could have amazing self-efficacy for driving. You could be the best driver in the world, most confident driver in the world. But if your car breaks down, have you got the most self-efficacy around fixing your car? Right. So you see there. So self-efficacy isn't a catch-all term in that sense. Fixing my car is very, very different to driving my car. So my self-efficacy can be very high or very low given the different context. And I think that's my point with self-efficacy, that it's not standalone. It's not an umbrella. It relates to different things. And even within those different things, it could be high and low. And I think that we use it in the wrong way, that we, you know, we just say, well, self-efficacy. And, you know, it's just like a, you know, like a buzzword. And I think we could probably do better with that.
It's absolutely a buzzword. And that podcast was a kick in the gut for me personally, because that was a buzzword that I guess I hadn't better defined before throwing it around a lot. And so when he was like, hey, man, we can't actually affect this stuff. People think that, you know, just because you do manual therapy on them, that they're going to like fall, like their brains are going to fall apart, not being able to understand what's going on. And so it was definitely a cognitive dissonance time for me when I had to look harder at, you know, what that meant.
Yeah. And again, I think there are a lot like biopsychosocial, you know, there's a classic buzzword. If I ask CJ or then I ask you, Joe, what it means, you might give me a different answer to what I mean. Because there aren't many well-defined definitions of the term. And so I think that you can have two people sitting on a podcast agreeing with each other who may actually mean two different things when you actually delve deeper into it. Yeah. So, you know, I think there are a lot of buzzwords. I think we could probably do better, you know, I think part of the problem is, you know, we all want to justify what we do. So we'll say, well, my treatment affects self-efficacy. Well, I always say a self-efficacy for what? And why would it do that? You know, it's how would it do it? And why would it do it? And if you can't answer those, then you're just probably using a buzzword to justify what you do.
Right. Yeah, I think this all kind of continues to come back to like our profession as a whole of like, we can define the same term, you know, 100 different ways from 100 different people with the same general direction. But since we're dealing with pain and the person in front of us, and like you said, and there's just so many factors that play a role into them, everyone has good meaning. Everyone has good intentions. And most of us get good outcomes, right? With 100 different approaches to the which I think is like what creates a lot of this confusion and not a lot of linear viewpoints on what maybe something like self-efficacy is, right? Because, you know, whoever, you know, Chad Cook or you know, the people that utilize this as their priority, especially remote stuff, you know, they're probably getting good outcomes with their patients, even though by definition, they might not agree with how we view it or how you view it or how Chad views it. And so I think that's a good thing because people are improving, right? Which is the main goal, is this patient centered. But you know, that's like the flaw in I think like utilizing pain is like the outcome measure for all of it, right? I don't know. It's tough. Like it's really tough. People get outcomes, but maybe they don't agree with what you said. And so I think it makes it really tough to define what's right and what's wrong.
I don't even think we define outcomes very well, if I'm being honest. So yeah. I think for most patients, they might come away and feel better. What does feel better mean? Does it mean I move better? Does it mean I feel better? Am I emotionally in a better place? Is my pain better? Have I got more confidence? So I think that we have to remember that actually in the real world, outcomes and what better is, again, generally are a bit of a web of like, what the fuck, you know, if I'm being honest, but it's very, very subjective. It's very, very subjective. And I think that people, when they come away and feel better, you could say how long, how much, and there's, you know, scientifically, when you try and delve into that, you'd sometimes maybe, is there even a point? I don't know. Then throw in things like, you know, natural history. If you are measuring things, you might have to talk about regression to a mean, you know, because we know that's a phenomenon that exists when you do measure things. So, you know, post hoc reasoning, why did it happen? You know, that's my favorite. They always got better because of me. So I think it's a real minefield. And, you know, I don't think that helps either.
No. Right. I mean, so go ahead.
I was just saying, I think I know the answer to this. Do you feel we have to navigate it, or how do we navigate it? Or is it something that, you know, we just continue to create a patient-centered approach and move them to the direction that they want to go as the patient?
A question I always ask, you know, often is if we do take a more of a person patient-centered perspective, let's say that didn't produce better outcome measures, you know, whether that's a SPADI or a COOS or a, you know, whatever else, composite outcome measure or pain, NRPS or whatever. If it didn't make any improvements, is it not worth doing? So do you measure the success? How do you measure the success of something?
Right.
Is it that someone feels better about the experience of being with you? Or is it just this, you know, kind of quantitative outcome does that take precedence? And it might be for some people with chronic pain, for example, that you never change very much if you're measuring stuff, but they feel better about the process and they feel, you know, they feel better about living their lives, even though their lives aren't quite the same as they'd like or the same as they were before. So I think there's a real question of what do we measure? How do we measure it? And, you know, what's the importance for that? And there was a Dave Nichols blog that came out a few days ago, actually talking about that measuring stuff in therapy and kind of, you know, again, everything has to be quantitative. And, you know, that actually goes against the BPS model. Engel was arguing against everything having to be quantitatively measured, you know, so that provides how do we reconcile person-centered EBM and the BPS? That can be a real struggle.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's such a minefield. I did a presentation on like, what does it mean to feel better? And it lends itself to this problem where if we're just focusing on feeling better without focusing on, I guess, I want to say like the mechanism of feeling better, then we can kind of just do whatever and do anything under the sun in a guise that the patient will feel better or that we're telling them that they'll feel better. And then I think that things can get off the rails at that point. And so I'm curious as to like, can we, like, I don't think that we should just go based off of, you know, I've seen it work. I've seen the patient feel better from this. So that means it works. What sort of like criteria do you have for interventions that I guess you put your big green check on for people to feel better with?
Well, I mean, again, what's the first key for me is often defining what better is, you know, and I think there's a real problem sometimes that we don't define what is a good outcome. How do you ever know that you're achieving a good outcome if you never define it? So I think there's a great paper by Linda Carroll called Defining Recovery. And that was a game changer for me as a paper. It really resonated with me at the time. And it said, you know, kind of, we're not defining recovery. How do we know if we're there or we're going to get there? And that doesn't always need to be, you know, how do you define that? That could be something like the patient-specific functional scale if you need to do that. But I think we need methods that are flexible if we are defining things and we are recording things, because there's great work by Tanya Gardner that looks at outcome measures versus patient goals, and they just don't align. Patients don't care about range of movement. They don't care about strength. Tanya would even say patients don't actually care about pain, which was really interesting, that pain wasn't a well-trod outcome measure in her research. You know, so actually people had goals that related to them and weren't simply definable to classical outcome measures. So, you know, my first thing, when I sit down with a patient, I'll always say, you know, recovery is a strange word because recovery can sometimes mean return to normal. This is something I've discovered quite recently. But I think we need to sit down and define with people what a good outcome would be. And once we've defined what a good outcome is, then we probably know how to get there, right? And then you can choose an intervention. Sometimes people choose the intervention first because that's what they like. That's what they use. Right. And that's bollocks. That's bullshit. You should use an intervention because it achieves a goal. And we get it the wrong way around. So define the goal, define the outcome, define the recovery, and then think about the best way to do it. Not, I do dry needling because I get good outcomes, because that relates in no way to the person you're working with.
Sure, sure. I think along similar lines, I would like to know what, I think it's along similar lines, what's salutogenesis? Because I've seen you post about this before. It seems like a great way to go about things. You know, I don't know why I haven't heard about it before. So can you bless our ears about salutogenesis?
Yeah, look, I mean, salutogenesis is one way to look at it. So it's one terminology for a version of the similar bunch of things. So it's by a guy called Anton Antonovsky. So go drink a bunch of bourbon, say that 10 times, see how it comes out at the end, right? So Antonovsky, I think he was an American, but it's a bit of a Russian-y kind of name. And salutogenesis really is looking at positive things. So we tend to look at the people who do worst, right? So you'll take prognostic factors and you'll say, who does the worst? What predicts the worst outcome? Whereas actually, salutogenesis would say, what predicts the best outcome? So what are the assets of people who do well, not what are the deficits of people who do badly? So it's taking a different approach. So we could say, rather than focus on trying to fix things that are bad, can we work on things that provide positive things, right? So it might just be another way to work with people. Sometimes the things that we are trying to achieve are very, very difficult. Let's look at some of the biopsychosocial risk factors that we have, you know, like loneliness, like social deprivation. You know, these are large social determinants of pain and health. Sometimes we can't always work on these things. So could we alternatively work on things that are positive, that provide an asset-based approach, that look at things from a positive perspective rather than fixing a negative perspective? So could it be helpful sometimes when things are very difficult to have an effect on? But are there some other things that we could do that maybe could offset that? Now, great example recently with things like fear avoidance is that interesting research comes out saying that actually fear doesn't have to decrease for people to overcome their fear. So do they build another skill that overcomes fear? Does that make sense? So rather than reducing fear, you are building another asset that enables you to overcome your fear. Now, I don't want to use the term courage. It would be a bit obvious, but maybe that's it. I don't know. So do we always have to... but it would be for an action, right? So I think maybe another interesting approach, and again, you know, we are getting into the realms of theory in some ways, is that maybe everything doesn't need to be fixed. Maybe sometimes we can build another asset that enables us to overcome things.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've done early on in is like, no matter what the first session the patient comes in, is like, I try to let them leave with a win, right? Like whatever, you know, so we see athletes primarily, and a lot of them struggle with back pain or shoulder pain and things like that. And so they want just something to do, right? And we have a different approach to working with them, is more of a coaching approach. But usually the first session is like, you know, they struggle with squatting, it hurts to squat. So instead of like trying to really break down why it might be hurting, you know, usually we just try and find an entry point of like, let's just find the win, right? And let's not prioritize like the negative of why you're here or what you're not able to do. Cause most of the time they really can do what they're not, what they feel they can't do, and maybe just a slightly different format. So I call it like finding the win initially, to create a little bit of buy-in and create a little bit of like positivity in their viewpoint of their situation. So I think that's kind of like what you were saying, right?
Yeah.
Like the overall outcome of focusing on a positive rather than like hyper-focusing on the negative of why they walked in.
Yeah, I think that probably fits into that. But I think it goes deeper than that, actually, CJ. I think actually what you're talking about is physio or therapy or any type of physical therapy really, for me, boils down to creating confidence and optimism. Right. I think that's generally the biggest thing that I do with people who come to see me. And it sounds like you are trying to do the same thing. Does that person leave with more confidence to challenge themselves to do some things maybe that they didn't want to do before? Right. Do they come away with a different mindset that is, I can do things rather than I can't do things?
Right.
So I think there's two aspects in there. One is that optimism is a massive part of the human condition, and confidence is a massive part of the human condition. And when you get into the biomedical perspective, it doesn't fit, because, you know, confidence isn't a part of the tendon, is it? Or confidence, you know, part of your disc. But it's a part of human beings. Mm-hmm. And any coach knows that for a player to go out and practice and do things into the dark when everyone else has gone home, they need something to drive them to do that. Now, for some, it's optimism, confidence. I need to do this to feed my family. But it provides us with some aspect of motivation. And I am here mostly, I believe, to be some kind of conduit to introduce optimism, motivation, and confidence into the person that I'm working with. And their job then is to build on that and, you know, believe a little bit in what I'm trying to do, and then do all the things that need to happen. So I think it's perfect, that confidence coaching mentality. And that's where coaching is about humans. Sometimes therapy is about bits and pieces of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I'm curious as to, I've heard you speak in the past, and I think I might know the answer. What's the difference in your dictionary with exercise and movement?
I mean, for me, I think all exercise is movement. I think that all movement isn't exercise. I think there's the big difference for me, right? So you can tell I've probably said this before, but I'm sure I've got loads of bullshit sayings that I've said for years that piss people off. But yeah, so I think all exercise is movement, but not all movement is exercise. So exercise can be really great because it provides structure, it provides guidance, it provides, you know, a way of doing things that some people really, really resonate with, but not everybody resonates with it. So I think in essence, what we're after is movement. You know, we're after this person. And I don't really give a shit whether people exercise. I don't care. Couldn't care less. What I care about is whether people achieve doing what they want to do. Now, can exercise be a way of getting to that end goal? So, you know, do I want you to be better at doing a pelvic tilt? Do I want you to be better at doing a squat? I don't really care. But I do want you to have the confidence and the ability to go and do exactly what you want to do. Now, for some people, that is a movement. It is an exercise. For other people, it doesn't look anything like the exercise. You know, but if you're exercise focused, you care about the exercise they're doing. I think if you're more of a person focused, you care about what that exercise leads to in relation to what that person wants to achieve. Mm. So I think we get caught up in exercise and, you know, strength, and this is the right way to do things. And I mostly think that our patients would see that as a means to an end, not the end itself. So again, if you have a mentality that's based around exercise, I think that's probably more of your bias rather than where is your patient wanting to get to. And I think that's the big difference.
Yeah. I think a lot of us can get clouded in our own echo chambers as well, and the selection process that we go through to bring clients who are looking for what it is that we want to give. And so I think it can seem like what we're doing and what the patient is asking for is the same. And so it can be a very, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think that's because we haven't defined it.
Yeah.
That's the big problem, isn't it? It comes back to, we think we're doing what the other person wants because we haven't actually ever asked what the other person wants. We've just assumed.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, we definitely, I mean, our niche is CrossFit, right? CrossFit, strength sport, which is movement and exercise. But it's definitely a very interesting way to come about it, that you don't care about the exercise. And I think that, not that you don't care about it, but you know, you just said what you think about it. But I think it's definitely kind of aligns with our thinking that you can move through space however you want, but to achieve a goal in a context, there are certain ways that you have to do them. And that, I think that would define it as exercise better. I don't know. I think I have to think about this kind of stuff more.
Definitions
yes,
your ass.
Definitions are the worst.
And sometimes we don't stop to think about what we actually
definitely
mean.
Not, yeah.
And I think the more we do that, both with our peers and our patients, I think the more we're going to be able to actually get aligned. Because if we're all talking about different things, then we're not going to be aligned on these things.
Yeah. Yeah. CJ, anything?
No, so just my personal thoughts. So it's interesting, right? Because I've had people, obviously, like we've been very exercise focused, and I've gone away. Like when I first started, it was like perfect movement, posture, blah, 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 right? Always. And because the people come in, they exercise, right? I have very few people that are averse to that term or that it's not part of their life, right? And so, but I do have people that come in that don't. And I have a person specifically in mind that had some neck pain. And I just gave her a few things, right? And she just works with her hands all day. And you know, she owns a coffee company and in town, and they bottle all day, right? So she's here. So she has a lot of like cervicogenic tension and headaches and things like that. And you know, it's been told that she has poor range of motion, and then, you know, she has great range of motion, and you know, like, and so I gave her a few things that I thought would really help, that if she did consistently, and I know she didn't do them like more than maybe 48 hours, maybe. And cause I see her every 2 weeks, I buy my coffee from her. And then we saw each other again and she was like, is this something I have to do forever? And it's just like, and so like creating, and like I definitely did a poor job of like creating the relationship of like, this is just things that, you know, that potentially could help. It's not, you know, and she was super averse to the term exercise, right? Like she just potentially wanted to do some yoga because people have created this relationship that yoga is different than like exercise and weight training, and it's not. And so it's like, it's so tough. There's like this like line to like feather with someone like her. And I don't think I did a really good job with it, but she seems to be getting better, right? Just like some probably, you know, natural history and regression. And so, but I know she didn't do the things because I think she created this, they were just a little bit of movements, right? And some bracing that I felt would kind of maybe reduce some of her pain over time. And I think she just like didn't have a good relationship with the term exercise, and I wouldn't even consider them exercises, right? And so it was just an interesting situation that kind of came to mind as you were talking about it.
But maybe, you know, I think we have to redefine what we do that helps people. Sometimes it's just coming into contact with us, right? You know, but it's same in research, isn't it? You know, people in a control group sometimes get better, or we see change. How much of that is just being involved in a research study? You know, just being involved in the process, just seeing someone. Mm-hmm. You know, but interestingly, I'm just going to bring a point up here. You know, we talk about you need to get more strength and get stronger. Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, what happens when you start strength training, get stronger, and then stop strength training?
You get weaker.
Let's say you get weaker. So let's say you strength train, your pain changes, you stop strength training, but your pain doesn't come back. What does that tell us?
Yeah, but it probably wasn't. It sounds like I don't think either of us have ever. I mean,
What I'm pointing towards here was her question. How long do I need to keep doing it?
Right.
Does that make sense? So how long do I need to keep doing it for? Mm-hmm. So if we follow the route that strength and pain have this great relationship, like some people seem to do, you know, this idea that you stop strength training, you get weaker. Well, your pain should come back, but that doesn't always happen, right?
Correct.
So again, sometimes people need to engage with something that has an effect on them. We don't know what that effect is, at the end of the day, it might not be for whatever reason, like the strength, because if you don't keep doing it, you probably get weaker. And by that reasoning, you should get your pain back.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
I'm curious, Ben, what's your self-education schedule like?
Well, so at the moment, we've got a new, in terms of what am I looking to? I think, where am I going with my education? I do a lot of education on a weekly basis in terms of reading research, in terms of communicating with other people around topics, etc. So I think still something that I could work on, definitely, I think it is more my communication skills. But I think that's something that I'd like to approach, but I don't always know if I want to approach it in a way that is very method related, if that makes sense, because we've got a lot of methods out there around communication and interaction, etc. So I think that's still something that we all need to work on. But I'm looking for something that I think fits my view, not fits my views, but fits the way that I like to interact in terms of education. But I think that sometimes, I think this is really important for all young therapists. Don't always wait to go on a course. You can read, there's more than enough to read. And sometimes reading makes your own thoughts, if that makes sense, you know, discussing and interacting. So it's good to do formal education in terms of, you know, CPD, but it's also good just to read shit and read widely and keep on doing that. And I think that's really important as well. So, you know, we have things like podcasts, which is great, which is Ben's opinion or CJ's opinion or Joe's opinion. But then also let's go back to the original research and say, what does that say as well? Mm-hmm. You know, not just what does some dude in a class say? Let's have a look at the actual data and the evidence that it's built from.
It can, the evidence can be quite the elephant to eat, so to speak. When, you know what I mean? Like, a classic saying that my dad would say is, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time, sort of thing. But just looking at it, you know, you can go down this whole rabbit hole for weeks on end and then see that there's a totally contradictory rabbit hole, you know, that you can go down into. And so it can definitely be like, I think I have like 50 tabs up of papers.
Do you have Netflix?
Of course.
Right. So do you ever look at Netflix and go, oh my God, there's so much on here, I'm never going to watch all of it.
Yeah. I still watch that stuff, though.
There you go. That's the point. So I think sometimes an easy way to view research is say, oh my God, there's so much of it, I'm not even going to start.
Yeah.
But if we all took that view with Netflix or Amazon, you'd never watch anything, right? Oh my God, right. I'm not going to watch it all, so I'm not going to watch anything. So when we set up the BCP, we talked about being somewhere between Instagram and academia. That's our little tagline, right? Because I think there's a lot of great stuff on Instagram, but also it's a lot of opinion, and I contribute to that. It's a lot of, you know, very, very, it's like veneer, isn't it? It's like very, very kind of big words to get likes and all these type of things. And then there's academia, which can be hard to penetrate, and it's its own problem. But I do think we need to maintain deep thinking and deep learning and deep reading. And I think if we go down the idea, we're always going to go on a course or always, you know, get our education secondhand from someone who's read the research, then I think that's going to cause a problem within itself.
Yeah. It can also be daunting talking to people like you who have been reading and doing stuff for so long, and people like us who, what, CJ, we've been out for like 5-6 years now.
Well, yeah, it'll be 5.
Right. Where it's like, how are we ever going to keep reading for that duration of time and still be confused about it? You know what I mean? It can all be very daunting.
I really appreciate that. I think it's your mindset. Yeah. I think the mindset has to be a fluid, open one whereby we understand. Look, again, science in general. Would you expect your car to look different in the 60s to the 2020s?
Yeah.
Why does it look different?
Because things have updated. Learn new stuff.
Then you've just answered your own question. Would you expect your heart surgeon to perform the same technique on you in 1960 as they do in 2025? You'd be pissed, right? Yeah, if they didn't go in through your groin and they opened you up from your chest to your nuts, right? So this is the game. This is what you've signed up for.
Yeah,
you have signed up for working with a scientific profession that is constantly updating and changing and moving forward. And that's happened in electrics. It's happened in plumbing. It's happened in building cars. It's happened in every profession. Mm-hmm. It's part and parcel of who we are engaged in the world. And so science changes, ideas change. And actually, if it all stayed the same, would you enjoy it?
No, definitely not.
And that's the other point. So, you know, we can't, if everything stayed the same, you'd be bored as fuck.
And it's interesting now because things are changing. And I mean, I have this such a small keyhole that I feel like I look through currently, because I know the BPS model, right? But I know that there's like an inactive model, and I know that there's significant other models that represent pain and experience and perception and reality. And it's just, like, it'd be so much easier to just stick in my little keyhole and learn all that. But I realize that there are things
Are you getting caught up in the details? Sometimes we get caught in the weeds, don't we? Yeah. And one of the reasons that I've taken to approaching things more about the person I'm working with is because you get caught in the rabbits of all the rabbit and the headlight and the theories, right? How many of these things are actually helping you?
Right.
It's not always helping you. You know, you're worrying about not knowing all the theories. You know, what does it matter unless you're arguing on the internet or whether you're, you know, involved in academia?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I think we need knowledge, but I think sometimes we need to realize knowledge is acquired. It isn't downloaded. Right. You don't download it end of year
not
seven.
Yet.
No, yeah, not yet. Say, all right. Fair enough.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Want to talk about that.
Get us there.
Here.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It is a process. Yes. And I right. think most people just, we just need to sit back and not want to be any further than we are.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to accept it. What
I'm
else can you
read
do?
Anything today.
No, but then, again, can you get caught up? You get caught up in wanting to know everything. You don't spend any time on yourself as a person. And then you're a shit therapist because you're tired and you're cranky. And so, you know, I think it's important that we realize you can't know everything ever, but certainly not when you're 25 or you're 30. You know, it's a process. It goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. So that leads me to my next question. What makes you not a shit therapist? Meaning, like, what do you do when you're not doing this? So, like, what keeps you grounded? Like, what do you read, or what do you watch on TV? What do you do socially? We know your counter partner does like lots of, he says, everyone, this is like the best shoulder exercise. You do that every day too. And like post your pictures of your fitness or anything. Like, what do you do outside of the PT world?
So firstly, I mean, I wouldn't suggest that I'm not a shit therapist. Who knows? I mean, Jesus, I'm more than, if someone said to me, Ben, you're shit at this, I would more than be happy to say you're probably right. But what, you know, I think there's like today, I was playing some cricket with my son, you know, so spending time with my son, spending time with my family, I think that's important, you know, and I've been very guilty in the past of not being present enough. And one of the amazing things about this whole lockdown thing is realizing, you know, that when you're traveling all the time, you don't get to spend as much time and be as present as you'd like. In terms of exercise, it's probably quite well known. You know, my thing is boxing. You know, I like to go two or three times a week and you know, get hit mostly. Sometimes I try to hit people. Mostly I just get hit. And, you know, I think for one of the big things I've done quite recently is I moved from London. So I moved from London to Kent, which is another part of England. So it's like moving from New York to the countryside type of thing. Okay. You know, you move into, you know, out to the coast, New England or some shit. I don't know. But, you know, and what I've realized is that it's just, you know, just taking a moment and not and just, you know, not having the madness of London and the city has been a real benefit for me over the past couple of years. Just being able to have the sea and be able to have the coast and just be able to have some headspace as well. I think we all need that. You know, I struggle as much as the next person, you know, with your emotions being up and down and stress and all these other things. And
like me.
No, you're as high as a kite, buddy.
So much.
Right. You need to like smoke some shit to bring you down. So look, I think whatever it is, we all need to, you know, and like just reading books that like last night I was sitting in the bath and then I thought, shall I read something, you know, related to research or shall I just read a fucking book? And I just decided to read a book. And so sometimes it's just switching your brain off, I think. But I want to point out, I'm really rubbish at switching my brain off. It's been a constant struggle for my entire life. Sure. And it's something that does lead you sometimes just to be a just tired human being and just, you know, just turn the switch off and go to sleep.
Which is good for the rest of us. Yeah. That your brain doesn't turn off because we can.
Oh, no, that's information. That's very debatable, buddy. That's very debatable. There'll be a bunch of people out there who'd say it's not a good thing. It's a real bad thing.
Well, cool, man. We really appreciate all the time. We want to respect your time. I'm sure you have better things to do. Where can the people find you? I know you talked a little bit about it throughout the podcast, but where can people find your stuff?
Yeah, I'm not particularly hard to find. I'm probably pretty profoundly outspoken. So you can catch me at www.corekinetic.com, which is my company where, you know, I have my course kind of hostings and that kind of stuff, where I'm going to be around the world, hopefully again later this year, next year. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, and I'm a internet hype job mostly. And then also you can find me at the Better Clinician Project with my partner in crime, Adam Meekins.
We told Mark Cargill this, that we were hoping that the Clinical Thinker podcast would make a return, but he said he wasn't very sure that would happen yet.
Oh, I love Mark and Jared. We had good fun doing that. It just ran its course.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Well, cool. Thanks again. And we really appreciate it.
Wait, we got our last question. Stop.
I thought the what are you not a shit clinician?
No. All right, I got two.
You guys need to get your shit together.
Dude, tell me about it.
He messed up. So my first, so these are totally random. So what do you like most and dislike most about when you come to the States?
What do I like? I dislike that everything's really expensive and I dislike tipping. I'm going to be honest. I hate tipping. It's not in the British culture.
All right. That's yeah, it is. I know. It's so weird. So I traveled out of the country a couple of times and it's totally strange that tipping is, it's weird that we don't.
I just love it. You know, I've got lots of friends in the States. My best man at my wedding, you know, he's an English guy. He was the best man at my wedding. He lives in Palm Springs. He was living in LA before. So, you know, I've got so many friends in the States and that's what I enjoy the most. I just hate tipping.
Perfect. Good. Joe, do you hate tipping too? You're one of those?
Well, no, I don't know. I go back and
forth. All right, good. All right. Adam, thank you. Ben, thank you so much. You said Adam.
Oh, my gosh. Thinking.
Ben, thanks so much for hopping on the call, man. It was great.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
All right, guys. I appreciate it.